Hey everyone, I'm Matt.
And I'm Steven.
And you're listening to
Code Talk with Matt and Steven,
where we sit around chatting about code and stuff.
This is episode number 2, Surviving the Long Haul. And today we're going to discuss redirecting with status codes in PHP. And Matt will discuss a little bit about moving from Mac to Windows and back, and surviving long projects.
So sit back and enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome back. It's been a little while since our last recording, so I just want to talk a little bit about what we've been up to. Steven, you go first.
Well, I finally launched a project that I've been working on for 11 months at work. That was nice to get that off my plate. Just been working on a few other little things here and there at work. Pretty much trying to maintain a work-life balance and cut it off at 5 o'clock and go home and actually enjoy my time. But you know, I've got, you've been through this. I've got a 4.5 month old on my hands. So, you know, it's pretty much just survival at this point. It's not a lot of free time. I did actually finally get to catch up and watch Rogue One, which, is in my opinion, the best Star Wars movie ever made.
It was pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah. You actually got to go see it opening night, right? Cause you missed our Upstate PHP Christmas party to go see it.
That's right. I did. Yes. Yeah. It was good. I really enjoyed it. I got to see it in a 3D IMAX kind of deal and really enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah, it was man. Fun. Yeah, we just got a new TV. We decided to take some of our tax return and go get ourselves a new one that will last. My wife called it Steven proofing it. You know, she was like, get something that may be a little more expensive, but you're not going to come to me in 5 years and say, I want a new TV. So we got, you know, a bigger OLED TV.
Nice.
Through the Blu-ray on top of that, and oh my gosh, it was a great experience to be able to watch that.
Yeah, I bet that was really nice. Very cool. Yeah, good purchase.
What about you, man? How's it been since we last spoke?
I am currently, actually, we're recording this now where I am job free. So I took on a new position. I start Monday. I'm looking forward to working with an old buddy of mine and just kind of finishing off with the last company I worked for, contract. So moving to a full-time position. So kind of really, really doing good right now. I'm just kind of finishing things off. I do a lot of DevOps stuff. So, you know, kind of one of my ending tasks was to just kind of help them finish off some of the more complicated pieces that they had, you know, get things moving, you know, or transition to other team members, as well as just kind of add some new DevOps items, mostly just, you know, cleaning up Docker and optimizing just, you know, the process. So there was a Vagrant environment in the mix. So originally, right when I created the local environment, Docker for Mac was in beta and it wasn't quite ready for prime time. So in order to, there's the OSX FS file system. It's a bit slow, so we ended up having a lot of problems with it. So we decided to use Vagrant as a proxy. So, you know, this last little bit, I actually removed that, got things working just straight with Docker, and it's running smoothly.
Do you notice a lot of improvements using Docker over Vagrant, like less system resources, like memory and RAM and everything? Kind of, is it less with Docker since it's more closer to the metal, I guess?
I haven't actually had a chance to play with it that much, but yeah, I mean, I haven't, you know, seen the difference, you know, with the application I was working on, because I literally just finished the switch yesterday. But just from my experience on, you know, just small projects that I, you know, I'm playing around with some libraries or, you know, just setting up something really quickly, you know, I find working just in Docker always to be faster, you know, because you don't have this VM on top. And then, so I'm running a VM, and then I'm running Docker in that VM. So that's how our setup was. So I'm getting rid of Vagrant. It's going to, you know, definitely speed that up. So
we are actually at a Help Scout in the process. Something I begged for about a year ago, and we're actually close to launching it now. We're rewriting our dev tools, our local dev tools, to move away from a Vagrant box that we built to go fully Docker. So we've got a DevOps person that's their main project, and I'm really excited because I'm on a MacBook Pro now, the 13-inch MacBook Pro with 16 gigs of RAM. But a year ago, I was on a 13-inch Air with 8 gigs, And I mean, and the Air can do anything you really want to, but our VM, because we had like, I think, three Java applications that had to run inside of it, a couple mm-hmm. of PHP applications, a few, you know, other databases and everything, and APIs and everything. So to test our system, you had to boot up everything. And man, your fans would kick on. The rest of it, you couldn't have anything going. You'd have PHP yeah. Storm, you'd have your browser, and you'd have the VM. And that was all you could afford.
Yeah, I had a 13-inch MacBook Pro with 8 gigs, and I ended up having a lot of problems with Vagrant. Or just, you know, I have PHP Storm open, I have, you know, at that point, Skype, HipChat, you know, or Slack, or email client, and, you know, you have all these tools just kind of going at one time, and yeah, it just kind of kills your machine with 8 gig. It really does. But...
All right, man. Well, let's get into the topics that we want to discuss today. The first one being, it's a short one, but it was something that interested me and intrigued me and really kind of bugged me, you know, no pun intended, but it was a bug I was looking for in a system, in an integration I was writing for Help Scout, and I was trying to redirect with one of our, you know, reusing some of our tools. So we have a web utils class that has a whole bunch of things like getting, adding headers, redirecting, doing everything for us. And I was trying to reuse it. And it takes a second parameter. It takes the URL to redirect. It takes a second parameter of a status code. And so I was passing it in. I was like, well, you know, the operation that we just finished succeeded. But now I need to go to another page. So I sent in the URL to the next page and then a status code of 200, just not even thinking about it, right? And it would never actually redirect. It would never do anything. And so I was just looking at everything. I was like, what's going on? Ended up stripping out all of the code I'd written and just trying to do a redirect. Still wouldn't work. And then finally just stripped away the helper class that we have, the helper method, and just did, you know, the actual call, PHP method or a function call to the header, set the location, and it would work. And I was thinking I was doing something wrong with the actual location header, right? I was like, well, the status code doesn't really mean anything, right? At least in my mind, because it was a 200, right? Everything was A-okay. It's the location that's not been, you know, respected. So the browser's not following the location. So I was really hung up on that. Started doing some Googling, you know, setting headers with PHP. It won't redirect. Ended up on an issue page on the Slim framework GitHub page. Mm-hmm. And someone in the very last comment, someone actually points to the documentation for the header function in PHP and actually mentions that according to the 1.1 HTTP spec, user agents should actually only respect the location for a redirect if it's a 300 or 3XX status code. And so I was like, well, I guess that really makes sense. And then you actually go and look at the PHP documentation, and it does mention that when you set the location, if you haven't already sent the header of status, PHP will automatically set a status header for you of 302. So it's another one of those things that PHP is doing, you know, behind the scenes that you just take for granted and that you're unaware of until it doesn't work and you have to go digging through the internals, right?
So
I was reading the spec I was reading the PHP docs, I was reading the spec of HTTP 1.1 and the RFC and everything. And so, I mean, in hindsight, it makes sense, right? You won't redirect unless you've got like a 301 or 302.
Right.
So I was able to fix that problem, but that ate up about 5 hours of my time the other day. But... good news was, after I fixed that, right, took away the status code, trying to pass that in there, everything just worked. So
nice. I always find that with bugs and things like that, it's usually something tiny. You know, you're just like, what is it? I'm missing something, and I just got to figure out what it is. And yeah, so good job going through the docs and stuff, because that's usually kind of like the last thing I do. So I'm like, there's no way this is not working. What's wrong?
Yeah. Right.
It must be my, you know, my setup of PHP or, you know, something like that. So,
yeah, exactly. I must have sent a malformed URL or whatever it was, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so. But what it actually made me think was something interesting is the fact that you can it's like I said, hindsight, right? You think about redirecting, and you have, you know, helper methods. You have, if you do it in PHP raw, you have to have the header, and then you have to set the location of it, right? But then we use frameworks so much that we never really write those raw function calls. So like in Laravel, right, you just take the response object, and then you can call a helper method on that says redirect.
Right.
Or even there's a redirect method or a function that's built into Laravel, and you just pass it in. And so all of this stuff that we're just so accustomed to ignoring that we forget what happens under, or don't even pay attention to what's actually happening under the hood. Yeah. And so this was a case of that. But it brought something up. It made me think was, you know, the fact that you can pass a location header back and pass a different status call, status code to it. You know, so if you're using AJAX applications and you're doing a call out, you can pass a 200, 201, 202, whatever back and just send the location. And then that's, you know, if you need to do something in your single page app or, you know, something on the front end with JavaScript, you can then now check that header. You don't have to pass back an arbitrary header or a response body parameter of where you should redirect to the next, right? You can just use the built-in location header.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah. Yeah. That would work great.
All these tools, man, people, it's all there for us. We just,
Well, I think that's the thing about experience, right? It's like, you don't know it until you learn it, or you know what I mean? So it's like, now you're like, oh, I could use this all the time.
Right.
But yeah, it's just one of those things, you know, I feel like I know what I know because experience has brought me there. Like some, you know, something I was working on or some bug I had to fix or, you know, just something along those lines has taught me that, you know, taught me something new. So, or even a podcast like this.
There you go. I just had to share that. I did a write up in Slack and had to share it with the team because I took it to two other guys on our PHP team that, and they were like, "I've never heard of that." And so I was like, "Okay, cool. It's not just me, right?" It wasn't something that I was obviously missing. But so yeah, that was just one of those weird things that you just ignore and take for granted. So
yeah, I agree. It's just too easy. Most frameworks just, you don't even think about it. So
we should just go back to writing raw PHP, no frameworks.
Oh my god. Ooh. You know, actually, I probably, you know, I should do a raw PHP project sometime soon, just for fun. Just to get back to the old days. I remember doing that kind of stuff. You know, building your own framework or something like that. That was the good old days. Yeah. When you were learning. You know.
And that's the thing, though, is if you try to start out doing just plain PHP, as you go along, you're probably going to end up writing your own framework, right? Because you're going to, oh, I need to abstract it out this way, and I need to use this, and I'm going to reuse this here, and then you have classes. Then you, all of a sudden, you've got a framework.
Exactly, yeah.
I have the same problem when I try to use the Slim PHP framework. I recently tried to rewrite, I don't know if I mentioned this in the last podcast or not, but I recently tried to rewrite upstatephp.com using Slim. Because right now it's on WordPress and it's a pain in the ass. Like, I think something's happened to the database and I can't get in it, you know, to log in at all. And I was like, well, screw it. We'll just rewrite it. Because I never update the thing. You know, it's mostly static, but has a few dynamic pieces. So I was like, we'll use Slim. I love it. I never get the chance to use it and I want to use it. So I started writing it. And then as I got into it, I was like, well, if other people are going to work on it, I need migrations. And so I wrote my own migrations integration, you know, how to generate and create migrations and run them, you know. And then it was like, I needed something else. And I wrote this. And then I pulled in this package. And before I knew it, I was like, well, shit, I'd be done if I'd used Laravel. You know, so everything gets out of control. And that's our curse as engineers, right? We always just try to do things better or more abstract. And then it's like, wow.
Well, we tend to overcomplicate simple things.
Yes.
So you're like, you know, something really simple. You're just like, like you said, abstract it out, do all this fancy stuff. And later on, you're like, yeah, I could have just done this and it would have been fine. I think that's and then maybe that's, you know, you get that conversation of refactoring, right? Because you don't know what you don't know. So you're sitting there just trying to do the best and trying to make it, you know, flexible and reusable. And, you know, and then when you're done, you're like, yeah, all right, let me just go clean this up. You know, and I think that's I know this is probably off topic, but I think that's kind of a, you know, exercise that I don't think a lot of PHP developers do. Usually I write code a lot faster than a lot of the people I work with, but I also take a lot of time. Like, I write something and then I stop and I look at it and say, okay, how can I clean it up? Even while I'm writing it, I'm already refactoring it, right? So I get to the end and I'm like, okay, cool. I want to change this file name or this class, this namespace, or, I want to move this into another folder, because as it grows, I'm trying to make decisions as I'm building it. And so I'm like, okay, yeah, let me stick it in this folder. It makes sense now. But, usually you get to the end and you're like, yeah, it doesn't make sense anymore, because now I have all these other things, or maybe I need to, create a new, either like, service or something like that, or, just another namespace to hold all these classes. So, yeah. I don't know what I was trying to get to with that, but yeah.
that is one of the most difficult things, I think, in programming, and that's what always gets me is how to structure your application. First of all, if you're trying to do something, there's probably already a pattern for it. So what pattern are you trying to, would be best to use here? Or are you trying to use to get what you need done? And then it's, how do you structure that? Do you try and do everything, domain driven, right? And so you have like a blog posts folder that has its model and its service and its repository, everything's in that. Or do you have a models folder and a services folder and a repositories folder where everything's broken out by type instead of, the domain, the object of it. Yeah. And so that's where I always struggle with that.
I typically take a domain approach. So, I kind of, like say, I use Laravel a lot. So usually like my folder structure within the app is I have a services folder, and then I have an entities folder. And then the rest of the Laravel app is sprinkled with really just generic setup Laravel stuff, right? So in my services folder is anything that's kind of abstracted out. So, I have an email scheduler that I've written that, usually goes into a lot of my projects. So it's really a service that, interacts with Laravel, and it, can be used, by all of the entities. And then, domain driven, the entities would be, users or just really anything else, companies or, that kind of stuff. So, and then within that, that's where my repositories, my models, all that kind of stuff kind of sits. And the reason I do that is because I like, I have this goal of, really doing a, awesome microservices project. So I'm really good at doing services now and smaller services, but I don't think I know the definition for microservices really isn't defined, but to me it's more of, the Lambda kind of stuff, where it's really just this one job that you just kind of, you hit this service and that's all it does. Right. So, I had this goal one day to actually start building microservices, but when you're starting a project, that's a lot of work, for little return. So if you go with a more modular approach, you can really, if you ever get to that point, you say, yeah, I want to actually just start breaking this stuff out, giving it its own database or giving it its own, set of servers, that scale or that kind of stuff. Then, you'd just be able to grab that entities folder, take all the abstractions that you have from the main Laravel app and, put it somewhere else and it's ready to go. So,
yeah, I mean, and I've read many articles on monolith versus microservices. Microservices is like the buzzword, the new big thing, right? Like everybody wants to build microservices. But I think a lot of people's mentality, because that is the new one, the new thing that's kind of in the community and prevalent, is so many people want to jump on it early. And like you said, it's we tend to overcomplicate things, and so you also say you don't get a lot of return, from investing in that early. And so I saw a really good article. I can't remember now who wrote it or where was it or where it was, but I can find it again and put it in the show notes. But it was talking about really talking about building your application first as a monolith, mm-hmm. and then after you obviously launch it, get it out there, start tweaking it. Then you can refactor out, you start seeing what your services would be, right? Because you can't think about abstractions ahead of time because you just don't know what you don't know. You don't know what you're going to need until you need it. And so you build what you need as this giant big framework and one big code base, and then you break it out. I think the same article, it could be another one as well, but they talk about the Google the Google code base is actually like a multi-million file line giant monolith. So like everything at Google apparently is one big monolithic repository. And so everybody commits to that. They have like hundreds of commits a day. But they said what's really cool about that is if you introduce a feature and you break something, you're responsible for fixing it everywhere.
Right.
So like I think they use Dart, the Dart language a lot to do a lot of their Angular stuff and everything like that. And so they, you know, if they introduce a break and change, you know, anywhere that's using Dart or whatever, they actually, the person who introduced that feature or break and change, then has to go update all of the other code bases that use that.
Wow.
So, yeah. I mean, that's kind of cool. I mean, it's kind of cool. Yeah. It works for them. But, yeah, I think the point is, right, not to overcomplicate things before you need to.
Yeah. I mean, because especially if you're a small team, you know, usually if you're starting a new project, let's say you're, if you're starting a new project, you're trying to get it off the ground, you're trying to get customers on, you know, all those kinds of things. So you have this timeline, you know, where it's like the budget's going to run out, right? So you need to get people using the service as soon as possible. So when you start breaking things out into services, then that very thing you talked about is like, okay, so I made a change here, API change. So, you know, you probably do it that way. So then you have to say, well, what services does it interact with? And then you have to go and change all those. So to me, a service-oriented architecture, especially microservices, makes sense for teams, like for separate teams, right? So if you were for more like enterprise software, where if, you know, you have, you know, a development team that, you know, consists of like 20, 30 people, then you could start breaking out those people into small teams and say, okay, your focus is, you know, the users and the login and, you know, the security piece of that. And, you know, you manage this service and that service can have its own services. Right. And then, you know, this other team focuses on another core feature of the app and, you know, and just constantly grows from there. But yeah, if you're a small team of like, you know, typically 3 to 5, it's hard to manage that many services. And it takes, then you have to hire a smart DevOps person who can actually manage all that deployment and, you know, those kinds of things. It's tough, like, especially if you've never done it before. So, yeah, I agree. Monolith, break it out as you grow and you just keep going that way. And it does seem like the smartest approach right now.
Sounds good. So on the topic of overcomplicating things, tell me your story about moving to Windows.
Yeah, let's talk about Windows. Okay. So for the last few months, the end of 2016, I've been on the lookout. I've been, you know, saying that, okay, I'm going to purchase a new computer. So I had my old late 2013 MacBook Pro, 8 gigs of RAM, you know, 256 hard drive. And, you know, for the last couple of years, it's done a great job. It's served me well. But I was always hitting that memory threshold. Things kind of get bogged down. I'm like, you know, all I really need is memory. But so, you know, it was February. I was working, with some of my coworkers. We had a meetup and, you know, we had a split team. I think I was the only Mac user on the team, actually. So, so with all the, you know, Windows computers in the room, one of the guys there had a Surface Book, you know, Surface Book Pro, and I saw it and I immediately was just like, oh, that thing is awesome. You know? So, you know, I got to play with it for a minute. I was really impressed, right? I was like, okay, this is my next machine. I'm going for it. So a couple of weeks after that, I ordered my Surface Book, came in, and, you know, there's a lot of things I knew before I jumped into Windows 1. I haven't used Windows in years. Like, it's been 10 years, right? So I knew there was going to be that learning curve of, you know, jumping in something different. Cool. All right. And, you know, the whole command key versus the, you know, everything with control, you know, just stuff like that. So I was definitely prepared, but you know, there was a lot of bonuses there. You know, I would Hyper-V for Docker, which I use Docker all the time. So yeah. Oh, awesome. They had introduced the WSL, so Windows Linux subsystem. So that means I could write all my scripts still in Bash, and you know, everything would work. And you know, I was like, you know, super stoked about it. You know, and then I, you know, being a designer from back in the day, I still use Photoshop and a lot of Adobe tools. And again, here I go, we've got the Surface Pen, you know, removable tablet, you know, and I could sit there and draw and all that kind of stuff. So messing around with all that, once I got it, I was in heaven, right? But then when I was like, okay, now I need to actually turn this into being my system, right? I need to be able to use this with all the things that I thought I could do. So, you know, using Bash for my, you know, PHP Storm terminal, you know, connecting to Docker on Windows and, you know, running all my environments, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I, you know, I'll be honest with you, like for the first, so I spent about 2 weeks, well, maybe not 2 weeks on and off, you know, just every couple of nights, you know, a couple hours trying to get this set up. But, you know, one of the things that was really frustrating to me was I did anything and I had to restart. I had to restart for everything, right? And then, so you install something, restart the system. You couldn't, so it was fine, you know, I finally got things kind of set up, you know, you have the multi-desktops and, you know, swipe gestures and all that stuff works. So I finally got things to a point with some frustration of just learning, you know, learning Windows. You know, I was like, okay, now it's time to integrate. So, you know, I bought the little dock for my, you know, Thunderport monitor, but, you know, and everything. So, you know, I started plugging it in. And so the first day of work, I actually realized that, okay, I can't unplug the monitor from the laptop and switch from laptop to, you know, the high DPI laptop from a high DPI screen, because then everything changed, right? So half of my programs had this text that was like, you know, I don't know, 48 point, you know, the other half was too small, or, you know, that kind of thing. So again, I would have to restart. And every time you restart, that means you have to set everything back up. So, you know, you have PHP Storm open, you have Docker running, you know, your email, all that stuff. And, you know, so it was driving me nuts. So I couldn't get my keyboard working, and then I would unplug and plug back in, you know, same kind of issue, would have to restart, but then sometimes my USB devices wouldn't work, and I was losing it. So I had, you know, my first day of working with it, you know, I didn't get any work done. And so, you know, I'm keeping this short because I did have a lot of frustration with it, but I overlooked him. I was like, it's going to be fine once I get used to it. But when I couldn't actually do any work, I was done. so I sent it back. Yeah. And then I waited a few weeks, right? And I said, okay, cool. All right. I guess I'm just going to go with the Mac. You know, and I was like, I really liked Hyper-V and Docker. I mean, Hyper-V and, with Docker and Mac. I mean, with Windows. So, you know what? You know, I have boot camp. You know, I'll work on that. So I got myself, I was like, you know what, screw it. New MacBook Pro 15-inch, you know, with all the, with the touch bar and all that stuff, right? And so far, I love this system, but I don't know that, you know, I made, the trade-off was actually, I don't know, very similar. Like, here's my problems with Mac now. So before, I had my 13-inch MacBook Pro, it worked flawless. You know, so the whole time I'm working with Windows, I'm like, dude, I could just unplug, plug back in. You know, I just did whatever and it worked, right? I didn't have any issues. I was on El Capitan at the time, so I never switched to Sierra then. So this new MacBook Pro, I can't unplug and plug in my monitor. Same issues I had with Windows. Half of my USB devices don't work. So I'm actually surprised. I have to restart to get my Yeti USB mic to work, right? My wireless headphones don't work. My external hard drive doesn't work.
Wow.
Yeah. And then half the time, so when I'm plugging in my monitor, my Thunderbolt monitor, I actually have to open the system, let it, you know, kind of, you know, log in or whatever, then I can plug in my monitor. But I can't, if I plug it in beforehand, it takes like it takes a few minutes for me to get a screen. So there's a lot of issues, and I don't know if it's Sierra or if it's the new MacBook Pros or what, but, you know, honestly, outside of that, I mean, this thing runs like a dream, like everything runs, you know, so I have Parallels running with, you know, with Windows, you know, I have all my stuff running and it doesn't skip a beat. So I guess the moral of the story is I feel like it's actually pretty even. If you're going to switch to Windows, just be prepared for a lot of frustration, right? If you use there's no touchpads in Windows, so you can't buy an external, you know, trackpad, sorry. But honestly, I don't know that – I feel like Apple's kind of – I don't know what their problem is.
Yeah, they've gone downhill in the last few years. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just their quality is just deteriorating. And I actually found out a few weeks ago that they apparently have merged their iOS and macOS teams into one OS team. And that's why you're seeing a lot of crossover and porting of features from iOS back to the Mac. I think the Touch Bar, I mean, I haven't played with it, but man, I remember thinking it was the most ridiculous thing ever. Because the point of a keyboard and the point of taking keyboarding in school is so you never look at the keyboard. You know, that's why we make fun of the people who hunt and peck when they type. And as a programmer, having these shortcuts and the function keys and the escape key, you know, the physical keys, being able to just reach up there and tactilely touch them and know where they are based on position, you know, that's invaluable. And so I just remember thinking, like, wait, so now not only do I have to look down to look at what it's displaying, to look at the virtual button that I need to press, but it also changes based on the application that's in focus. So like, I can't just be using Chrome or doing whatever and hit a pause button, you know, to pause Spotify in the background or whatever.
So far for me, it hasn't brought any, you know, hasn't brought anything to the table, actually. You know, so you're right. Like, normally it's going to show this bar with the, you know, it's going to show you like, you know, audio buttons or whatever. It's got a little slider. I mean, it's kind of dumb, really. I mean, I haven't used it for anything because I'm in PHP Store. I'm in my normal apps where I know all of my, you know, shortcuts, right? So the PHP Store, I have to set it, you know, I had to go in and set it to actually show the function keys. But my biggest problem with that is instead of an escape key with the function keys, I actually have a done button. So it's either I have to hit function and then actually hit a function key, or I have to do function escape on the touch bar in order to escape in PHP Storm. Now, I'm sure there's probably some way to override these things. I haven't dug in too deep, but it hasn't brought anything to the table for me, at least. Like, it's kind of useless. It's just something on there. But
I remember laughing at the video. Like, I watched the live stream of them back in the fall, kind of showcasing or showing this, you know, in the touch bar, and they were so proud of it. Apple's always so proud of their products, and they had they always have people from the industries, different industries, come up and demo stuff with what they're doing with the new cool products. So they have this guy who used to be a DJ, but now built a DJing application, I guess, and he came up to DJ it. Or to demo, you know, the touch bar, and it shows him like doing mixing and doing a little different like DJ moves on this half inch tall touch bar. And I just remember Twitter and Reddit and the whole internet like that I could see was just making fun of this because they were like, there's no self-respecting DJ that would ever sit up there and actually use this tiny little thing. Like, it was hilarious. It was. I don't know. I can't see. But anyways, Apple's got their quality's gone down here. I think this rapid release cycle that they've adopted, you know, doing a major OS release every year is ridiculous because they do this push and then they just have bugs that live for a whole year if they ever get fixed. They don't do incremental push, you know, updates as often. So they don't fix these bugs because they're working on the features for next year.
Yeah. And here's the thing is, like, I know the USB thing, you know, I would have return this if I you know, thought it was a problem with my laptop, but I know the USB issues are abundant. So, like, there's lots of people with these issues. I don't know how Apple is getting away with these issues. The other thing is another thing for a lot of people who buy MacBook Pros, because they do Windows and OS X development, right? Or Mac OS development, or iOS, whatever. So they need to be able to run both systems. So right now, if you're using Windows Hyper-V, if you have it installed on your Windows in Bootcamp, you can't actually load up Windows because it slows it to a crawl. So that's an issue with both Apple and Windows. So Apple has Windows requires this like CMOS or something like that. So I did some research on it, and Apple, does the EFI. So Windows doesn't support the EFI, and Apple, of course, they won't put that back in. So now it's up to one of the companies to actually fix it. So there's a lot of people, especially there was a way to boot it on the older MacBook Pros, 2015 and previous. But now the 2016 MacBook Pros, you can't get it to boot at all. So I actually have to go through Parallels in order to use that feature and to use Windows, the Bootcamp version of Windows.
I think I'll just stay with my 2015 MacBook Pro. And we sit here talking about this, and I see a tweet come through. Josh Lockhart at Code Guy says the Windows Linux subsystem is getting better, and then he links to an article. That should be an interesting read. But I'm actually quite surprised that Windows is doing that they're making such a push.
It's fantastic, actually. I think the subsystem is actually with the creators update that was released, I think yesterday. Yesterday was the 11th. They actually fixed an issue that I had. So when I was setting up my system, I had to install Docker in the subsystem and then, kind of link it to the host system, right? But now with the subsystem, you can actually – that's so I can just run Docker commands like Docker, Docker compose, all that kind of stuff. And then it would just send those commands to Docker on the host. But there's a lot of path issues there. So that was another frustration I had. But now I believe the subsystem, you can actually with the new update from yesterday, you'll just be able to use the subsystem and say, and run the Docker command, and it will actually run the exe file from Windows. So they're doing some really cool stuff. And I think with this new update, it would make that integration. If you're if you're somebody who uses Linux all the time for development, especially web development and Docker, subsystem's awesome. So then you don't have to change how you work because you don't have to use the command, the command prompt or PowerShell, right? So, but now you have three options. It's just like, oh God. Yeah. So Windows 10's a mess. It really is.
They should just rewrite Windows from the ground up. Just rewrite it completely. Just base it. They should. Windows 11 should be a new flavor of Linux. Just adopt a Linux kernel and just build on top of it. Just say, sorry, everyone, we'll support Windows 10 for 10 more years. And then that's it.
Yeah. I don't see it ever happening.
No.
I got more complaints about Windows, though, if you want to hear them.
Let's move on.
All right.
I think we could do a whole show on complaints on Windows.
Yeah, I think so.
All right, so let's move on to surviving the long haul, working on long-lived projects. Obviously, working in the software industry, right, you're working on the same project, the same product, really, for a long time. Like, that's your main thing. I've been at HelpScout for 2 years now. It's help desk software, so I've been working on the same product, the same code base for 2 years, which is, I think, my longest that I've ever worked on the same code base. But within that, you have different projects, right? And a lot of those can sometimes turn to be long-lived projects, and that can take its toll on you. At least it does to me mentally, right? You kind of get isolated from the rest of your team. I started to question, why is this taking longer than was originally thought? Is it me? What's going on? Am I not doing this correctly or doing this right? Is there a better way to do it? Would someone else have be done by now? And you're kind of living on this little island, this deserted island, like your boat, your plane crashed here. You're the only survivor, and you're almost getting your cabin fever. You're going insane, right? Because it's just you and your thoughts. or you and a small team of people, you know, thoughts, but still it's just, you're separated, you're segregated from everybody else. But what's your longest project that you've worked on?
Well, the longest project, I think the longest project I've worked on, it took me actually about a month, and that was taking, and that was doing some DevOps work. So I was taking our original, you know, kind of CI system and moving to Amazon's ECS and integrating CodeShip and this whole kind of using their Docker Pro platform. And that means, and then containerizing everything. So all of our testing, all of our, you know, all of our deployments, you know, I had to write something to kind of stash our secrets and be able to pull them, just in the whole automated, you know, just auto scaling and all that with all these Docker containers and everything in Amazon. It took me a little over a month, maybe a month and a half. So I know I really wouldn't call that a long lived project, but that was a long time for me to be separated from the rest of the team. I mean, you know, normally just from being a person, I was kind of the lead developer at that point. So I was just kind of involved in everything. So I was always working with the team on making decisions on what to do, how to do it, you know, just all that. And then for like a month and a half, I was just kind of nothing but this one project because it had to get done. And yeah, when I was done, I was so lost, actually. I felt like when I came back into the crew, it was like, you know, what do I do now? Like, where am I? Where do I jump in? You know, it was a good thing, actually, because the rest of the team had to not rely on me so much. So, you know, it was good because I had spent a lot of my time just in meetings or, you know, doing all this, you know, just being a different part of the team and not coding and not contributing as much as I wanted to. So, you know, the good part is when I was done with that, the rest of the team had to just kind of step up and kind of start doing things themselves. So when I came back in, I actually ended up having more time to code, and it was great. So it sucked for a month and a half or whatever, but you know, it was worth it.
When you said you had trouble coming back to the team, did you kind of almost feel like you were onboarding again, like you were the new guy?
Well, it wasn't so much as that when I started that project, I had this place, you know what I mean? It's like, I knew when I went into work, you know, when I started to work every day, I knew I had my responsibilities. I knew what I had to do. I had to talk to, you know, just the whole routine. Right. And so when I got off that project, you know, that routine changed. So it wasn't necessarily onboarding. It's just like, now where do I fit? You know, now what can I do? Or, you know, that kind of thing. So it just took a little bit of, took a little bit of time to get reacquainted with just everything that, you know, that I was going to be doing at that point. So
it's like when you get done binge watching a show that has a lot of seasons, right? You get done with it and you're like, well, what do I do with my life now? Like, what do I move on to?
Yeah, exactly.
So my longest project, like I said at the beginning of the show, it finished back in late February, early March. It was an integration with Salesforce. It was 11 months long, and I was the only dev on it for, I think, about 9 months on it. I had a little help the last month and a half, which was great. But that had its own set of problems. But so it started out, it was funny. It started out, I get an IM in Slack from my manager, and he says, hey, I need you to just hook into Salesforce via OAuth. You know, I need you to write an OAuth integration. Okay, cool. And so I wrote that, and then it was very much like it you know, then it was shown to me that it was like, actually, you know, this is going to be a bigger integration. And none of us really had used Salesforce, and none of us really thought about asking our business development team, who actually uses Salesforce for their input, too much until later on in the project. And so I was actually, it was a cool opportunity. I did get to work closely with the CEO of our company because he was, this was kind of like his baby. This was apparently a big project that was meant to bring in a lot of new businesses. And so that was cool. It was like, wow, it's a responsibility. It's going to help grow the business, you know, whatever. And it's a project, a greenfield project that I get to work on. but we didn't have a spec to start out with. I had never used Salesforce. I don't think, you know, a lot of us hadn't, like I said. And so we didn't know what we were getting ourselves into. And so we're like, it should, you know, they have an API, they have documentation, it should be anything, right? We were also working with a third-party company that was building a separate integration in Salesforce that would hook into our product. And so it was working with that company, and it was, you know, we were, you know, trying to figure out how to work as a two-company team and everything. And then things just kept dragging on, because as I would solve one problem and build one feature, Salesforce would throw me, you know, 10 curveballs. It was like, oh, here's something that we don't really show in our documentation, or that it's hard to find, because they have a lot of documentation, but they actually do a new version of their API every quarter. And so by the time we started on version 36 of the API a year ago, and they're on version 40 or 41 now.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure what changes between the versions, but we kept it on the old version just because we didn't want to refactor every quarter. But it was like, so not only when you go look at their documentation, you have to make sure you pick the right version of it. And there's just so much in there that you don't know. And so it was like, you know, here's this weird edge case where we're going to return this error and this error message to you if this happens. And so it was, we would solve a problem and then we'd be testing it and we'd get hit with tons of things. And so that started in March last year. We went into in August, we started in beta. We got two customers on board and they were like, this is not how we use Salesforce. This is not what we want to really do. And also your product is throwing lots of errors. Like, what the hell's going on?
Oh man.
And so this whole time, every month long, you know, I'm sitting there now, it's, you know, what was supposed to be just a few weeks long project is many months into it now. The mind, you know, the mind starts to wander, and not with me with my insecurities. It starts to hit me of, you know, what am I doing wrong? Why is this taking me longer? You know, did they screw up? Am I going to get fired? Am I not doing this properly? It's just me on this island taking, you know, direction from the guy who started the company and is in charge of everything, you know, and is older, smarter, wiser, whatever, right? And it's just me, this lowly developer, just trying to survive. And so everything that comes through and I'm, you know, that we get a new error and I fix it, then I go to Nick, our CEO, and I say, you know, I have to try and explain it to him, say, here's the error. Here's what we got now that we didn't know about before until we got that. And so all of this takes its toll, because you're just, again, going on, the timeline extends and extends and extends. And finally, in October, we went on a whole company retreat. Nick and I got together. We sat down. We had a few beers. We hashed a few things out, and it felt good, right? It was like that human connection of being like, okay, we're in this together. Like, I want to know that you're on my side. You want to know that you're, you know, I'm on your side, and you're not alone. You're not on this island. You know, you're here. You know, we're here for you. And so that kind of brought me back a little bit. But then we decided to completely rewrite it from the ground up, almost. Because we then talked to more people who had better insights of what the product or the integration should do. And so we did that. And it finally launched. I took a month off for paternity leave, came back, and took a little while to kind of get back into the swing of things. But we did eventually get it done, get a good beta period, figure out a lot of things that, we didn't know. But then for the last month and a half, I had help. So we were able to meet our deadlines, launch it relatively smoothly. Yeah, it was, like you said, it was tough coming back. You know, it's like, I've been doing this for 11 months. You know, it's when I came back on, it was like, after the dust settled of the launch, you know, and everybody was patting me on the back saying congratulations. And you know, then it's a lot of, what do I do now? You know, what do I work on now? What's my next project? And it was also weird too, because we had hired a lot of new people, but because I was on an island, I had never spoken to him. And so it was like, now that I was back into the normal Slack channels and talking to the team and actually had the time to interact with some of these other people, you know, a lot of them were just like, who the hell are you? Right. So like, you know, they've kind of come on board. They've discussed, you know, and other projects, and they've worked on stuff. And then I'm now apparently all of a sudden this stranger who's kind of, I've been here longer than them, but I'm kind of the new guy to them because mm-hmm. I've been away. So that was weird. I think I kind of wanted to talk about this working on and surviving the long haul, right? I think the surviving part is I think just trying to communicate with your team, whether it's technically speaking or just wanting to feel a part of it, right? Like we are 100% remote at HelpScout, and so we use Slack as our primary communication channels. And so it's, for me, it was really trying to, whether I had the time to participate in conversations or not, it was trying to just at least keep up and read them. So I knew what was going on with the company. I knew what was going on with the team. You know, it wasn't like I got that and I was like, okay, well, who are all of these new people? You know, why did we do this thing, or what is this new project? And so it's a lot to digest. It's a lot to handle. But I think it takes that. It's a lot of work, I think, that you have to put into to really kind of keep yourself mentally in the game and mentally sane, I think, to survive that. You know, it's taxing when you're the only one on a project for so long, when you feel like you've been segregated and separated from the rest of the team.
I agree. I actually agree. And especially if you're put in that position where there's really nobody else that could help you, even if you could pull somebody in, you know what I mean, and work together with the rest of the team. You know, you usually reach a point where there's like, it would actually take more time to catch somebody up than it would be to finish it off, or at least you think it would. So there's that too.
Yeah. And towards the end, you know, we were really kind of feeling the pressure to get things done on time, because every deadline we set, you know, for 6 months we missed because Salesforce would just throw us another curveball. But it's funny, my you know, the managers and the coaches above me would ask, you know, well, if we can free up another developer to help, will that speed up the process? And every time it was no, because this was an interesting project. It was, every task was sequential, right? It wasn't like you could work on things at the same time, or even asynchronously between the two developers. It was, this has to be done, and then this has to be done. And so as I would also submit pull requests for peer review, as soon as I would submit it, I would still just branch off of the one that was just, you know, sent for approval, because I couldn't wait mm-hmm. for it to be approved before starting my next task that needed the work that I had just completed. And so it was very much, you finish one, you have to, you know, it's a dependency of the next one. And so it was like there was no room for another dev. And so that was also kind of taxing and kind of strange. Luckily, the work towards the end actually did free up to where there were some tasks toward the end that we could have multiple people working on. But yeah, that was lonely. Even right now, I'm sure on one that was supposed really to be, true. I'm on another integration that was supposed to be maybe 3 or 4 weeks long. And I think it's turning out to be about 12 weeks. So
are you working on that one by yourself again?
I started to. So I'm working on an integration with HubSpot. Mm-hmm. So again, they picked me because it's very similar to Salesforce, the type of integration. It's also a CRM. So we're working on that. But then another guy, a coworker of mine, is working on another integration. And he and I got to talking, and we saw that there were a lot of similarities between what I did with Salesforce, what I'm doing with HubSpot, and then what he's doing with this other integration. So we actually did combine our projects into one big board in Trello. And we've broken up the tasks, you know, like he's better at JavaScript, so he's going to take a lot of that for me, and he's going to abstract out to kind of make reusable components. I've also abstracted out what I learned on the last project and what I need to use for this one. And I'm creating reusable components. And see, it did add scope to the projects, but it's actually eliminated, I think, some of the time, because, you know, I'm not going to be writing the same thing that he's going to be writing. You know, we're writing one longer integration, but ultimately it's shorter than two smaller integrations.
Right. Plus, you actually have your code's much more maintainable now.
Right.
Since now that you're sharing all those components, you're actually benefiting all the future projects that are very similar.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Instead of having to maintain two different implementations of the same thing. Yeah.
And that's the goal. So we're hoping. So it's nice to be collaborating with someone again.
Well, I'm happy for you.
Thanks.
Man. Oh, cool. Yeah. I think we're kind of running out of time now, aren't we?
We are. We filled up a lot more time than I expected to.
Oh, thank you, Windows.
Yeah. I think we went on a few other tangents, but before we close out, I do want to mention, and I don't know if I've even told you about this yet, Open Upstate, the organization that I'm on the board of and a part of here in Greenville in the upstate of South Carolina, We are in partners with SC Codes. We're putting on a open SC hackathon on May 13th. So it's a Saturday. It's going to be an all-day thing. It's going to have two tracks. It's actually pretty cool. So the idea behind this hackathon is it's half of it is, and one of the tracks is a belated Open Data Day hackathon. Mm-hmm. So there are going to be a lot of people who want to come in, work on open data, kind of make projects, you know, get together, which those hackathons have always been a lot of fun. And then the other half is a kind of a training track where we're pairing mentors with attendees and, I guess, kind of students, if you'd say, where they're going to be focusing on committing their first pull request. So nice. We're going to kind of go through, and we're going to have a list of example projects, you know, whether it's just a bug fix or even committing to, you know, documentation changes. But we're going to mm-hmm. go through the process of, you know, of forking, you know, creating a different branch, you know, doing the changes, committing them, and then submitting the pull request to the open source thing. So it's very much and that's why it's called OpenSC, not just for Open Upstate, but it's also about open source community. And nice. We want to cultivate that and teach these people how to be a part of that community by committing their first pull request.
I really love what you guys are doing, actually, and some of the other training things that you've done. As I, you know, when I go to the user groups, you had the training track there too. That was really cool, the PHP 101. Yeah, so I really love what you guys are doing. So
thanks, man.
I'll definitely be there. So,
all right. Well, check it out. I'll put the I'll put the link in the show notes. But man, check it out, May 13th.
Excellent. All right. Well, I appreciate everybody making it this far. This has been Code Talk with Matt and Steven.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Code Talk Podcast, or online, codetalk.simplecast.fm.
Thanks for listening.